19, Frontier Number 1, Restoring God's Glory. The first question, we'll start with Janice this time. Since all societies' cultures are imperfect, should Christians be known as those who uphold traditional social and cultural institutions, or as those who revolutionize them, bringing greater conformity to standards of righteousness and justice?
Well, I thought this sounded a bit like a rhetorical question, because, of course, Christians should do the latter, since we're soldiers in a constant and complex battle against the schemes of Satan. We ought to live strategically as those who will bring about a change as God leads through His Spirit to bring about His kingdom on earth and in heaven. Of course, this is easier said than done, since we have a distinct tendency to build man-made systems of explaining our world, our God, and even God's Word. It's important to remain teachable and humble before the Lord so that we don't fall prey to the spiritual blindness that can set in when we rely on institutions and traditions rather than on the living God in doing this life. This appears to me to be a devious yet subtle scheme of the enemy and brings about apathy and a false security that all is well on the front lines, or worse yet, that there are no front lines to defend.
Well, okay. Marjorie?
Do you need another answer after all that?
Sorry.
Okay, I said that yes, they definitely need to do the second choice. John 3:16 says, the Son of God came into the world that He might destroy the works of the devil. We are to be about what God and Jesus are doing. We are to help bring His kingdom to earth. If we aren't doing anything, if we aren't also working with prayer and action and teaching others to fight the enemy, Satan, and bring heaven to earth, bringing no sickness, no pain, no pain.
All right, Paul.
So, Lord. Tradition is greatly entrenched and honored, but even as we rock the boat by telling people they're sinners, we must declare the whole counsel of God on all subjects and live accordingly. As conditions wax worse and worse, we must not knuckle under, but be part of the solution.
And Diane.
Well, our cultures are imperfect, only the gospel has the power to move them towards perfection. Hopefully this summit will revolutionize them and bring greater conformity to standards of righteousness and justice, especially where there is no Judeo-Christian tradition.
Okay, I think this question does, as you say, have sort of a rhetorical cast to it. On the other hand, it may be that the answer is not a yes or no, or one more or the other, but both, because it is true that traditional institutions, in many cases, are not totally evil, but do actually protect people from evil. And to overthrow all traditional institutions, we have seen many times down through history, in, for example, typical social revolutions, a great deal of anguish and bloodshed occurs, and very often the result is no better than the previous thing. Just putting, for example, putting poor people in charge of a country doesn't mean that you automatically get kindly, generous, truthful, or honest people. People are people. And a revolution which simply puts one group out and the other group in, for example, has, like in the case of the French Revolution, certainly not led to any great blessings. On the other hand, it is certainly true that there are massive social changes that have gone both for the better and for the worse. And some of them are very, very nearly invisible. For example, right now, a huge amount of evil derives from the breakdown of the American family. And the focus on the family, focusing like crazy, they are not dealing with the basic problem. The fact that our social structure tears the families apart. It isn't sin or stupid parents or whatever. It's simply the social structure that does it. Any society which sends the man in one direction, the woman in another direction, and the kids in other directions to maybe three different schools, is bound to cause trouble in terms of the family. And we don't realize that because it's part of the social structure. And no amount of band-aids and focus on the family materials are going to resolve that problem at its root. It can certainly help out in many cases, but there just is no obvious solution to a situation which tears the family apart. For example, in today's world, there are more workers that are separated from their families, and they're running the hundreds of millions of people who are separated from their family because of work being someplace else and their families being left behind. Now, you can go in there with tracts about how to get to heaven and four spiritual law booklets and whatever you want to do, but unless you can deal with that problem at its root, it's a band-aid approach. It's not a getting at the root of the problem. And things like that ought to be changed, but I don't see Christians doing much about it. They have reacted to the school system and kept the kids home, but that doesn't mean the father is home. And probably the most successful homeschooling families are those where the family itself, as in the case of Mary Pride, who's one of the writers of all these homeschooling books, she and her husband run a business in the home, and then the whole family is together. And that's a great solution, but it's not the solution she recommends. I mean, she can't recommend it because the structure of society is against her. And so there are lots of things we can see that are wrong, that have roots that we don't see and aren't even dealing with. And I think that in some ways, for example, the preservation of the Asian family link-up, where the family is very close, like in Chinese society, that's something that's worth preserving. It isn't something worth revolutionizing. But every Asian family that moves into this country, the family breaks down practically overnight. And so the answer is yes, yes, and no, no to that question, I believe. Yes.
I think the reason why I felt like it might be rhetorical is the qualifying part of the sentence at the end where it says, bringing greater conformity to standards of righteousness and justice. I think if that part of the sentence weren't in there...
You can't object to that, right?
Right, and so that made me think that as Christians we should, want to do that.
Yeah,
About that kind of justice and righteousness.
Well, that's understandable.
Okay.
Any other comment about the question of whether you do or don't revolutionize the institutions of society?
Just winsomeness. There's got to be some winsomeness, not just destructiveness, as you intimated earlier. I guess we hear stories about people who get very severe with others about sin, and the person comes to them, humbles themselves, but when it's a social institution, that may not happen very readily, widespread thing rather than the individual. So to go between the extremes is all I'm saying, calls for great wisdom and probably variation that the people are probably dealing with.
Have I mentioned the problem of, say, prostitution in Mumbai? Here is an illustration of roots of problems. You've got 400,000 workers from South India without their families at work in Mumbai, which is formerly Bombay. And you've got 40,000 prostitutes in that city. And there are Christian ministries that are dutifully and energetically bailing out these prostitutes one at a time, two at a time, maybe five or maybe 10 over a period of time, maybe 20, and rehabilitating these young women and so forth, and that's a good thing. But what's the root of the problem? The root of the problem is you got 400,000 men without their wives in that city. Now, these girls are Nepalese, all of them. They all come from Nepal. They just buy them. And if you were to say, suppose you were to rehabilitate 10,000 of them, all in a single day, take them all out and give them new jobs someplace else and completely rehabilitate them, within a month, those 10,000 would be replaced by more Nepalese girls. So all you're really doing in bailing out this prostitution is you're pulling more and more girls into prostitution. See, now that's not dealing with roots. The root of the problem would more nearly be dealt with if the government of India would say the companies, the businesses in Mumbai cannot lure men away from their families. They have to employ the whole family, the father and the mother and some of the kids maybe, or no, not at all. Now, we do that in this country. We say you can't build a building unless you have enough parking places. You know, we just say that. You can't do that. And I'm not making any recommendations about the politics, but I'm talking about the difference between dealing with the roots of the problem and the fruits of the problem, and what Christians should or shouldn't do really should gravitate toward the roots. And if that's revolution, so be it.
Well, at the other end, there's a root problem that's causing those families to sell their children. So something needs to be addressed in the structure of that society and the sin that is holding them back from being able to survive or value their children, or I don't know what the root is.
Those are Christian families in many cases. I mean, Christian families all over the world are selling their kids. Now, they don't do it because they don't like the kids. It's precisely the opposite. They can't feed those kids. They know if they sell them, they'll make a living, some sort of a living. In Pakistan, for instance, it's very common for Christian families and everybody else, not just Christian families, but the Christians are the poorest people in Pakistan, so they're the most likely to do it, to sell their kids, their boys and their girls, to shops which have them working 14 hours a day, sleeping right where they work, practically like caged chickens who are never out of that little cage all their whole life. And half of them die by the age of 12. They're so brutally treated. Now, the parents hope their children won't die by the age of 12, but they have no other options. You either starve or leave. You starve or you put your kids where they're going to survive. That's why orphanages are wildly acceptable everywhere in the world, because families give their children over to the orphanages because they'll get food to eat. And very few orphans are really orphans, yeah.
I just remembered something about one rule in Wycliffe. I don't know, maybe we have it also in the handbook for FMA, that husbands and wives cannot be separated for a number of things. I think it is a month or something, and it is in the handbook for Wycliffe. And also, the dependent children have to be with their parents, you know, wherever they are affected and so on. It is in the handbook. But I was thinking that there is an age where children should be with their parents, you know, when they are forming their world view.
Yeah.
And then after that, they can go their separate places. But when they are still dependents, that is the formation time. And the closeness of the family will depend on those years when there is bonding in the family. Afterwards, you know, that is done. I'm just thinking that I have not been living with my brothers and sisters, but we are really close-knit, you know. Whenever I go, whatever happens, I don't have to be proximate with them, because there was that time when I was bonding with them. So,
yeah.
Anyway.
Well, you know, I'd be more extreme than you are. I don't think there is a time when kids are then completely on their own. I think in America, it is incredibly stupid, but when our children get old enough to be truly helpful and advisors even to their parents, and to begin to reciprocate the wisdom that has been invested in them, helping their parents continue to grow. Then we send the kids out. Get them married, get rid of them. When I was in university, a friend of mine got married. He said, whenever you get married, move 1,000 miles away from both sets of parents. That's going to be happiness. That's a recipe for disaster, not happiness. But that's the American stupidity. It's just ingrained in our culture. It's absolutely stupid.
Well, people use Genesis 1 to justify it, too.
In what way?
You know, a man should leave his father and mother and cleave unto his wife.
Well, see, that's an American translation. What it means is that when a boy marries, his parents are no longer his parents. Her parents are now his parents. He cleaves to his wife's family. That's bloodline. The phrase, one flesh means bloodline. He's now, her father is now his father. Now, it doesn't mean he disrespects his parents, but he now has new parents to respect. And that's that continuity which the Bible clearly describes, which we boldly misinterpret to fit our culture. So we say when a man marries, he leaves his father and mother, and the wife leaves her father and her mother, which the verse doesn't say, and they form one new family, which breaks down real quickly. That's the way we do it. Half of all marriages break down because we've just decided that that's what that verse means.
I wish the two men from Nepal were here today. They were here yesterday, and he was telling me that women and children are not just children, girls, are considered objects in the Hindu religion. He was a Hindu leader, and that's one reason why they're being sold like they are.
Sure.
They're just objects. They're not
sure.
human beings. So,
well, even wives are objects in many cultures, you know.
Yeah,
and, well, when you talk about changing society, that is a big subject. So let's go to the second question. question two. What will you do to participate in the restoration of God's glory? Marjorie.
I took this to you personally, and so that's what you meant, or what was meant. So learn all I can as myself and those closest to me about the evils, corruption, and disease that need to be addressed. Pray for God's kingdom to come on earth in these areas. Ask God where he wants me to act. Begin doing it. I see disease as a top priority. I also see the helpless little ones. They tug at my heart. I want to help. Pray without ceasing. Learn to pray more effectively. Pray while doing. Faith without works is dead.
All right, Paul.
First, our own lives must be searched and continually placed to try not to bring shame to him. From a consistent, God-honoring platform, we can address and crusade for nearer fulfillment of God's glorious intentions.
Diane.
Well, because I'm a teacher, I put that we should teach the next generation what their purpose in life is, to restore God's glory. And my responsibility also is to teach their teachers the same thing, to see that we're in a war and not to passively accept evil as if it's from God, but to recognize it from Satan, to pray and to follow our prayer by action, to live a lifestyle as if there's a war going on, to simplify, to organize to fight Satan by reforming institutions, and that our energy should be applied to the destruction of evil and not to living a nice life.
Okay. Janice.
That's kind of along that lines as well. I said that I will endeavor to live my life in such a way as to bring hope, healing, and wholeness to the broken lives around me. I will endeavor to make the sacrifices needed to live a wartime lifestyle. So as we all work together, we can work together to restore God's kingdom. And I want to participate with God in bringing beauty from ashes.
Okay, actually this in a way is a trick question. I think in one way, in one sense, the best answer is nothing. There's nothing an individual can do. in terms of the huge problems that we face. And the, to say that, oh, we're going to do this, as an individual or even as a family, is virtually futility in view of the situation. For example, James Dobson is a good friend of mine, and I've written him letters from time to time. I wrote to him one time on the whole subject of the fact that in the focus on the family, they talk about children obeying their parents. But they don't talk about the fact that the God-ordained, God-designed family would be multi-level, would have three or four generations, probably four would be more normal. And so a child learns obedience by seeing his parents obey his parents. But not in America. No child in America ever sees his parents obeying the parent, that person's parents, the grandparents. Now, okay, what can you do about that? Absolutely nothing. How did it happen? We have a very interesting social structure called youth incarceration, which puts children either in two types of institutions, school or prison. Anyway, they're incarcerated for many, many years. They're not allowed to participate in society, not allowed to get married, not allowed to get a job, not allowed to gain any empowerment. They're kept children, and we've created a phenomenon called adolescence, where kids are very bright and very capable, but we give them nothing to do that's relevant or significant, nothing that they really respect, for maybe 8 or 10 years and postpone their marriages. That means that a kid's parents have no parents. By the time the kid is 12 years old, he doesn't see his parents obeying his parents. The parents are gone. We've pried the generations apart, and nothing you can do individually can solve that problem for yourself or for your own family. But I guess what we could do is to try to gang up in groups in order to resolve that problem. There was a book written by an Asbury Seminary professor, Donald Joy, when he talked about risk-proofing your family, and something like that. It went out of print, so we reprinted it, actually, in the William Carey Library. We used it as a study book for one of our staff retreats. He talked about the